It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a number of outdoors groups in Wisconsin are opposing the proposal to remove DNR scientist positions. We'll hear the argument against those cuts.
First state lawmakers heard testimony yesterday on the subject of campaign finance laws in Wisconsin. This comes as some state lawmakers consider changes to Wisconsin's already complex finance laws, ones that haven't been keeping up with the times, according to some who testified.
State Elections Chief Kevin Kennedy said that due to a number of court cases, Wisconsin campaign finance laws have become wholly inadequate to the times. Others pointed to the appearance of corruption as political donations get bigger, elections more costly than ever. That's got some calling for a total rewrite of the state's campaign finance laws.
Joining us now is Matt Rothschild, who testified at yesterday's hearing. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and the former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I want to start with a quote from yesterday's hearing. Madison attorney Mike Wittenweiler called on state lawmakers to get to work on Chapter 11 campaign finance laws. And here's what he said. He said, "Don't sit and edit Chapter 11. Don't sit and tweak things. Rewrite the damn thing." Do you think that's what's needed in Wisconsin, to rewrite Chapter 11?
Well, it is complicated and hard for the layperson to understand, and a lot of the court decisions have wreck some of the things in there, so it's not a bad idea to rewrite it. What concerns me, and what also concerned Jay Heck of Common Cause, who testified yesterday, is that some of the Republicans and maybe even a few Democrats in the legislature want to lift limits on contributions, and that's about the last thing we need. There's also a push by some Republican legislators to have less disclosure. Again, we need more disclosure. We should have transparency here in Wisconsin so that we know where all this money is coming from. I mean, our political system is awash in money right now, and to my mind, our democracy is drowning in that money. And to have less transparency, to not let the citizens of Wisconsin know where that money is coming from, I think is absurd and leads us down a very dangerous road.
If Wisconsin did go in that direction, what do you think would change? I mean, in light of recent Supreme Court rulings lifting aggregate campaign donations, Citizens United, would Wisconsin be more in keeping with the direction that may be trending?
Well, it's a terrible direction to be trending in any event, and there is a movement afoot here in Wisconsin and around the country to amend the U.S. Constitution to overturn Citizens United and to say once and for all that corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech. In fact, in 54 villages, towns, cities, and counties across this great state, people have voted by overwhelming margins that they're in favor of such an amendment, and there is a bill in the legislature that Lisa Subek introduced that would help us do just that. But look, what could happen if we continue down this road? There'd be perhaps unlimited amounts of money that individuals could give directly to candidates. Do we really want to go back 120 years to that kind of thing? Do we want corporations to be giving directly to candidates? I don't think that's the direction we ought to go to. I think we need to put the skids on this and turn it around.
Now, as far as Chapter 11 goes, what would you think it would be needed? What would need to be done to simplify Chapter 11 and make it more clear for people? Because right now it sounds as though it's a bit of a tangle.
Well, we need to have a clear limit on contributions and what they are. We need to define what coordination is, so it's clear that these so-called outside groups, independent groups, can't go meeting and strategizing with a candidate and say that they're not working together or coordinating together when, in fact, they're colluding together. So those are a couple of areas. We need to be clear on disclosure and what the disclosure requirements are so that the layperson can know what to expect. Those are the three biggest things that we're looking at.
Now, there have been critiques about disclosure, some Republicans saying that it may be unfair to disclose who a donor's employer is because that reflects more on the employer than the donor. What about that?
Well, it's funny because there was a funny kind of debate yesterday. Justice Antonin Scalia has said that people should be able to stand up and in public for their political acts, including contributions, that they shouldn't be afraid, and this wouldn't be the home of the brave if people weren't brave enough to stand up and say, you know, who they support. And so so it was funny for me, for one thing, to be quoting Justice Antonin Scalia favorably, which I was, and even funnier for one of the conservative lawyers on the Republican side saying he totally disagreed with Justice Antonin Scalia on that. And even in the Citizens United case, the Supreme Court justices, by a vote of 8-1, said that the people should have to disclose, not only when they are giving money directly to candidates, but when they're giving to groups that are even issuing just issue ads. So the courts, this is the one good area where the Supreme Court has made a stand for public transparency. And even that doesn't satisfy a lot of the people in the Republican legislature, unfortunately.
But what if your employer, you're the donor, your employer has one political perspective, you have another? Is it fair to you, the donor?
Well, it's disclosed that it is not the company that is giving the money. So actually the Republicans were worried about whether it was fair to the employer or not, whether it was fair to the employee. And corporations, bosses should not be able to discriminate against you for how you are voting. And if they're doing so, you should have some recourse in the courts.
We're talking about campaign finance laws right now in Wisconsin with Matt Rothschild of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And Matt, in your testimony yesterday, you said Wisconsin is overly dependent on large private contributions, which is subjecting our democratic process to a potential corrupting influence. Have you seen this in action during the past decade or so in Wisconsin politics?
Yeah, I cited several examples in my testimony, and the language you read really wasn't mine. That's in the statute. That's in the opening paragraph of Chapter 11 on Wisconsin campaign finding, a very good language, in fact, about the principle to limit the amount of money and to increase disclosure and to stop corruption. The clearest example, I think, over the last couple of years was when Representative Joel Clayfish introduced a bill that would have helped reduce the child support, of all things, of one of his largest campaign contributors. This was one bill that would have had tremendous assistance to his biggest donor, but would reduce child support. And who's in favor of that? And so that was a clear giveaway. We had a case of GTAC, Gogebic Taconite, giving $700,000 to Wisconsin Club for Growth in 2011, and they spent oodles of money on the recalls to keep Republicans in power, and these very Republicans then rewrote the mining bill largely along the specs provided by the company. You know, those are examples of potential corrupting influence. And I also cited one during Governor Doyle's time when he was raising money from the Ho-Chunk, Potawatomi, and Oneida tribes. And then when he got reelected, he gave them sweetheart deals on their casinos. So a lot of this stuff just doesn't pass the smell test. And what I'm afraid of is that we're going to have more and more corruption like this if the Republicans raise the limits on contributions or totally destroy those limits and don't give us disclosure.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He testified at yesterday's hearing on campaign finance in Wisconsin.
Whether you play them or not, video games like Call of Duty have become entertainment juggernauts around the world. One Wisconsin company helps make some of the most popular games on the market, and today we meet the man behind the sounds.
I've never even talked to anybody about this. I don't know how normal or abnormal this is, but I can hear things in my head. It's basically like they're playing out of the speakers in my car. I can just hear them. Like Mario picking up a coin is one. You ever played the game Mega Man? The little sound he makes when he teleports and... That one is just really iconic and it kind of sticks with you. My name is Mark Kilborn. I am the audio director at Raven Software in Middleton, Wisconsin. In the audio department, we're essentially responsible for everything that comes out of the speakers. Music, voice, sound effects. And in a game like Call of Duty, we have to build every little sound you may or may not hear. A character walking on dirt. We have to take microphones outside and walk on dirt and record the sound. You know, if the player is crouching and moving through a bunch of bushes and foliage, we have to create those sounds. A lot of people think of the big stuff, you know, helicopter crashes and guns and explosions and all that other stuff, but there's lots of little things too. So I can trace the interest in audio back to a specific album. I heard the album Please by the Pet Shop Boys. It had the song Western Girls that was really popular at the time, so I liked the music of it. But I liked the sounds.
In a Western town, a dead end world, the Eastern boys and Western girls.
There were samples you'd hear of traffic in the streets and all sorts of crazy stuff. At the time, I was like 5 years old. I'd never heard an album that was using all of these elements. And then I got a Nintendo when I was 5 years old for Christmas. Got way into video games, loved Mario, loved all these other things. And then one day it just kind of clicked. Hey, there's sounds in these games and somebody's making them. I wonder who that is. And that seems like it would be a really interesting job to have. It is a stressful job. It's almost a self-imposed stress. Because we're doing something creative, we want it to sound really, really amazing, and we're a very competitive team. We feel strongly that game audio on the whole as a field is not as far as it should be. And so we feel like it's our obligation to push things as hard as we can and make it sound as good as we can. I have no romantic ideas about the full impact of what I'm doing. I'm not curing cancer. I'm not doing anything like that. There are people that are having a much, much greater impact on the world than I am, but there's something magical about the fact that I've worked on something that is entertaining millions of people. And I know that there are people out there who had a horrible day and they can go home and sit down and play a game I've worked on and escape it for a while. And it's being able to build something for people that puts something happy in their lives.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Last week, 15 different outdoors groups signed a letter addressed to the State Joint Finance Committee opposing cuts to DNR scientist positions. The groups, including the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, Whitetails Unlimited, and the Wisconsin Trappers Association, represent more than 100,000 hunters, fishers, and outdoor enthusiasts.
George Meyer, executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former DNR secretary, joins us to tell us why these groups oppose the cuts. George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of groups, a lot of outdoor groups included in this letter. Why are so many outdoor advocacy groups speaking out on these budget changes?
Well, there's great concern over many of the issues in the governor's budget. For one, they're making the Natural Resources Board an advisory board. Sportsmen and women almost 100 years ago fought very hard to get a seven-citizen board to oversee conservation and provide some kind of buffer against getting political decisions in various environmental and conservation regulations.
Now, one of the things that's brought up in the letter and by other people worried about these budget changes are cuts to science in the DNR, cutting science positions in the DNR. What kind of changes would happen there?
That is of great concern. There's 18 positions cut in the department's Bureau of Research, and these are the scientists, men and women, who do the in-field surveys and projects to research projects to determine the various different species that are, you know, some that are hunted and angled for, but other species too, more endangered species. What is necessary to protect them, what the regulation should be, how the land should be managed to protect these resources. It is the fundamental building block of conservation and for managing wildlife in the state, and would be a tremendous loss if we lost that science base.
Now, Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany told our colleagues over on Wisconsin Public Television, the public is disconnected from what these scientists are doing, what hunters see, sometimes bad deer hunts, he says, in part based on the work these scientists are doing. So, long story short, this is one reason we don't need them. We're not getting a benefit from them.
Well, we're getting tremendous benefit from them. And as an example, this is what protected bobcat from being removed from the species that could be hunted and put onto our protected list. These are the people that came up with the science data that is allowing the wolf to be taken off the endangered species list. You know, these people do, I think over the last 2 years, did 330 research projects. Any one individual, Senator Tiffany, or maybe a sportsman, may not like the results of any one of those surveys, but overall, it provides extremely important work, and they are accountable to the public in terms of the type of research that is done.
And in other cases, maybe some of this work is redundant. We've got a research institution in the university here. We've got UW-Madison. We've got UW-Extension. When we need this kind of research, we'll go to them.
Well, that's not, but you know, I know from my personal experience as secretary, that would not work. The research that's done at the university is more on the cutting edge, theoretical, things like prions of CWD, not on the type of research that, well, will this type of size limit or bag limit work on this type of lake? It's a totally different type of research, and there's a cost overhead that, in fact, ultimately sportsmen would pay for.
Now, moving on from the scientist question, another change, land stewardship and purchasing land for stewardship. The case made, we're not ending it forever, but there's debt, a lot of debt. We want to have that paid down before we buy more land for stewardship and conservation.
Well, there's two sides to this issue, and I agree, and our organization agrees, in fact, we need to have some fiscal control and responsibility. But totally ending any public land purchase for 13 years goes way too far. We need to maybe scale down the program, focus it more on the critical priority parcels, but not end it for 13 years.
What do we lose if we don't have that ability to buy those lands, do you think?
Some of these parcels only come up every generation because of, you know, land ownership and passing on to the next generation. I know of one prime parcel in Devil's Lake State Park that, in fact, may be up for sale right now. And if that purchase isn't done by July, we may lose that parcel, which affects how the park is operated for, you know, 20, 30 years. You have to take advantage of these properties sometimes when they come forward, which is infrequent.
Speaking of state parks, the idea of self-sufficiency ending general purpose tax revenue, as I understand it, in the budget. Do I have that right? And what do you think of that?
Once again, this does go too far. You know, there's only $7 million, actually $5 million for operations and $2 million for roads that goes into the state park system from taxpayers. And we have one of the finest park systems in the country. It brings in hundreds of millions of dollars into the state. We're talking about a buck and a quarter per citizen a year to help support the system. And I'll give you one example of how it pays back. Devil's Lake State Park itself brings $120 million into Wisconsin's economy. $5 million, $7 million, whatever. This is a cheap investment for the economy and for recreation in the state of Wisconsin.
Is there room to tighten belts and still get a quality park system here in Wisconsin with a cut of some millions of dollars of general purpose revenue?
Well, an example of another state that another fine park system where they totally removed state tax dollars is the state of Washington. That happened about 3 or 4 years ago. They are closing state parks because the revenue from campers and people entering the park were insufficient. Park revenues vary depending on the weather. We've had a couple good years, so it's a little surplus, but that isn't going to happen every year in Wisconsin, and we're going to end up with a crippled state park system.
Well, with any budget, and this was a tough budget year coming out of the gate, there's the question of, you know, there are a lot of things we want to have in Wisconsin, some things we've got to have. Can you make the case that these various natural resources elements, the parks, the science research, other things we haven't even gotten into, should be at the higher end of that priority list?
Well, let's look at them. The Natural Resource Board doesn't cost the state anything, a few lunches a year. The scientists are not paid out of general revenue taxpayer dollars. They're paid out of sportsmen's dollars that we pay, and we want this used for research. I did say there needs to possibly be some scaling back because of fiscal situation with the in terms of stewardship. And maybe there can be some cutting of these parks dollars, but not removing all the money.
And as someone, a former DNR secretary yourself, someone who's been an advocate since then, what do you think of the long-term trends here, the message that we're seeing in this budget when it comes to natural resources here in the state?
This is the worst conservation budget I've seen in 40 years. And I know the history of the 10 years before that, which were very positive budget years for conservation. And, you know, Wisconsin thrives on its natural resources. And it's really a shame that this there's this strong anti-conservation bias in the proposed state budget.
George, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, telling us about the opposition to proposed DNR scientist cuts. We're talking about the next great migration. While many Jewish people discuss emigration in the wake of anti-Semitic incidents, our next guest wonders why Black Americans don't think the same thing. After some very high-profile police-involved shootings of African Americans, he says Black Americans should consider leaving the country.
Thomas Chatterton Williams is with us now to talk about the idea of a Black migration. He's the author of the book Losing My Cool, Love, Literature, and a Black Man's Escape from the Crowd. He wrote the New York Times op-ed, The Next Great Migration, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why do you think that Black Americans should consider leaving the country now as an option?
Well, I don't think that all Black Americans should necessarily consider this. I don't know that this is a solution for everybody, but I think that more Black Americans should consider options beyond what's available in the United States right now, and also just consider some of the satisfactions that can be had by pursuing the good life outside of the United States of America. One of the things that, you know, happens in America, in my experience, is that you watch all of this kind of vigilante and police violence against Blacks, and it may not happen to you, but it takes a psychological toll. And I think that, you know, if you just escape that kind of environment, you can find that it's mentally freeing.
It takes a lot of work to do that kind of thing. You're far away from your family, your community. There's culture shock, language barriers. Is it actually worth it, do you think, for African Americans to do all the time that it would take to invest in setting up a new social structure, a new community, just to leave the United States?
It's true. It depends on the individual. So one of the things that I was trying to stress in the article is that Black people are, you know, we have to think about minority individuality, and Black people are individuals. And so this might not be something that works for everyone. And African Americans are typically very community oriented. So maybe it's even especially something that many Blacks would find unlikely as a solution for themselves. But for many others, I think that it's something that should be considered. And I think one of the ways to get around some of the burdens is to look at it as something to pursue when you're younger. To get a foot in the door, you can look at study abroad programs, and then you can, you know, then you have your work invite, your work networks and social networks open up through that. And that's a low cost way of doing it, not necessarily just picking up your life and going when you're 50 years old, but maybe when you're 18, 25, 30, it's an option.
Now, you've got some experience with this whole topic. We should point that out. You moved from the United States to Paris, and as an African-American man, what has the difference been like for you?
I moved here twice. The first time was right after college. I came for a year to teach English, and that kind of whetted my appetite. And the second time was I married my wife is French. I married, we lived in Brooklyn, and then we moved to Paris in 2011, and I've been here since. And one of the things that's been so kind of rewarding about it, there's the usual difficulties, but what's been so rewarding is that the kind of anxiety and the stress and the idea of race oftentimes can recede from my consciousness on a day-to-day, week-to-week level. That's very refreshing. So I don't walk around the street paying attention to police. I don't think about, I don't wonder how I'm being perceived in the faces of strangers, or I don't wonder if I'm being judged or discriminated against in a way that I think many African Americans live with every day in the United States. So in that way, it's been very mentally liberating.
Well, you write that in Paris, you've never felt safer or less harassed anywhere. It's difficult to exaggerate the existential boon of shedding one's victimhood. That's a line from your piece. Can you talk more about that, what it feels like to shed victimhood?
Sure. I mean, I feel like this is not necessarily just my own experience. I feel like it's a typical experience that Black people in America can feel set upon and can feel that even if something doesn't particularly happen to them as an individual, that they're part of a group that is targeted or that is stereotyped, that is suspected of criminality, considered guilty before proven innocent. And so I think that these types of things, these are things that you can simply shed by changing your social context. The thing about race that's so interesting to me and that I've noticed over the years traveling and living abroad is that race is completely contextual. Being Black in America comes with a specific history. It comes with a specific set of assumptions. And these assumptions don't necessarily translate in different contexts. I'm in France, but there are many different social contexts with which Blackness operates differently than in the United States. And so it's true that France is not a paradise, and I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a place that's great to be African or from former French colonies in the Caribbean. But African-American specific culture and ethnicity does not bring with it the same set of assumptions and the same set of stereotypes and baggage that it carries in a North American context. So in that way, I think that, again, that changing context can be a liberating move for an individual to make, and that in this way you could find that you're not a part of a victimized group everywhere in the world.
We're talking right now with author Thomas Chatterton Williams about why he says more African Americans should consider living abroad. That's what he's done. He's moved to Paris, where he's talking about what it's like to shed victimhood. And this idea of an African American exodus, this is an idea that's had a go already from the earliest 20th century and on through the 21st. Why now, since it's already had some trial runs and hasn't really taken off?
That's right. Well, I think it has taken off. I think that throughout the history of the American experiment, there have been periods of lots of Blacks leaving. France has always been a magnet, going back to the early days of the country when well-to-do so-called mulatto elites from New Orleans, when they came up against the fact that they couldn't live in Louisiana at the level of their means, they were French-speaking Creoles, and they decided to finish their education and live in Marion, sometimes stay in France, and they found a better life in Europe, where skin tone didn't carry with it the same set of social restrictions. And then again, it happened after both world wars that, like, a lot of GIs just found that life was not so bad here, and they could kind of marry who they wished, and that people even valued the kind of jazz culture that they were a part of. That's the thing: Black Americans have a global cultural currency that I think that they would be able to cash in on a lot of other contexts outside of America. And so I don't think that this is something that hasn't worked in the past. I think it's just something that was able to work a lot better after both world wars, because the sheer amount of numbers of Blacks in Europe was higher than it might be now. But I think that this is a very good time for it, because you have very different it's much easier to travel and to move freely and to not leave behind your former life to the same extent that you would have had to, even in the 90s before the rise of high-speed internet.
Do you worry that what you're talking about might only be available to a certain part of the population, people with the necessary economic means, for instance, or social capital to be able to pull off a big move like that, but it wouldn't be available to people who didn't have those same resources?
I do think about that a lot, and the truth is that, do I think that Michael Brown would have been able to pick up and make a better life in Paris, and that the French would have necessarily not projected the same kinds of stereotypes on him as people in America did? I'm not sure about that. I don't know that it's a solution for everybody, but that's the thing. all blacks are not in the same position as Michael Brown. And so one has to live one's life, right? So how does somebody pursue the best life for them? For me, pursuing the best life is not necessarily to put myself directly in Michael Brown's shoes.
Now, Black Americans have a long history, obviously, in the United States. They've been part of its fabric, its culture for decades and decades. Isn't part of the valor, the better part of valor, to stay maybe and work for change instead of leaving?
Yeah, I think both things are very important. I think that there's always a balance and a tension between group membership and loyalty to the group and service to the group, and also individual freedom and pursuit of the individual good life to the best of one's ability. And so I think that there's time in life perhaps for both things. I don't know that the solution is to leave America forever, but maybe at certain points in one's life it can be refreshing and even necessary to be able to breathe again, to leave a stifling circumstance and to come back refreshed, rejuvenated.
We're talking right now with author Thomas Chatterton Williams about his idea that Black Americans should consider leaving the country.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of a migration of many African Americans out of the country, short term or long term, if you are African American yourself? Have you ever thought about doing this, moving on, trying your luck in another country? What would it take to make that happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with author Thomas Chatterton Williams, who says Black Americans should consider leaving behind the lingering inequalities in the United States and living abroad.
We're taking your calls. What do you think of this idea that the U.S. is difficult enough for African Americans that they should weigh the possibility of leaving the country? Would you do it? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our first caller now. We've got Samantha joining us from La Crosse. Samantha, hi.
Hi there. I just first of all want to say that I really enjoy listening to what the guest has experienced, and I very much respect the experience that he had. I think that's amazing. What I was wondering is if he could speak to how he might think this would work for other minorities. For example, I'm Native American.
All right. Well, thank you, Samantha. Appreciate that. What about other minority groups? What do you think about urging them to do the same thing, Thomas?
That's interesting. I mean, I think that it's a good idea for many more people. I think it's a good idea for all Americans to get out of the country and see the world in a way that American privilege and kind of expansiveness can sometimes blind us to. But with that said, many American minorities would find what I and some of my friends have found, which is that being American is wonderful and it has a lot of currency in the world. And when you take that with you outside of the country, for groups that have not always been able to experience that at home, they may find that they experience it abroad. I would imagine that a Native American might find very similar feelings of freedom that an African American can find outside of the United States.
A lot of the time when we talk about traveling abroad, living abroad, people talk about how it teaches you, first of all, how you're seen by the rest of the world, or you can put on a new identity, you can broaden your perspective of what it means to be a global citizen and not just a citizen of a particular country. Do you see an advantage for African Americans or other minority groups to try living elsewhere, trying on in terms of, broadening their consciousness and their perception of who they are in the world, and then coming back to America, bringing that with them and maybe sharing what they learned?
Absolutely. And I think that strengthens the community. You mentioned briefly, I think, in the intro, and the thing that got me thinking about this article in the first place is talking to my brother-in-law, who's Jewish, and talking about the extent to which Jews, in the wake of some anti-Semitic attacks in France, have been leaving, and all over Europe, have been leaving and going back to Israel. And I was thinking about the strength of this population that's been cosmopolitan for so many hundreds of years, millennia even, and what that actually has allowed them as a group to incorporate into their local cultures wherever we find them. And I was thinking, you know, Black Americans are a much younger group of people by millennia, but experience outside of the United States, while the United States will always be the context that formed this people, experience outside of the United States, I think, is the next step and is essential for being able to view our home country more clearly.
Let's take another caller now. We've got James, who's joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, James.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I traveled to West Africa in 2013, 2014, and in Jamaica this year. And, you know, for an African-American traveling abroad, you know, there's you get a sense of dignity traveling to these other countries, especially to, you know, to the homeland, that you're not afforded in the United States. You know, I'm not a native Milwaukeean, but I've lived here for like the last 13 years. And Milwaukee is the type of city that, you know, it just has its foot on the neck of Black folk, especially if you happen to be, you know, a person that has a criminal record or, you know, that's saddled with debt from the court. And to be able to travel abroad and be able to experience, and even if you're able to get dual citizenship, I think that it's something that every African-American should have the chance to experience or should experience and have the chance, you know, if we're not wanted here, to go someplace that may be more accepting or someplace that we are wanted. So we should have that option, definitely, especially, you know, homeland, which is Africa.
James, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Thomas?
Yeah, I echo much of what he says. I think that, this is something that is not specific to Blacks. I want to stress that travel is travel and even expatriation is something that is just humanly expansive. And since Black people are humans, they benefit from these experiences as much as anyone. And I don't even want to say that necessarily the experience in America is uniformly or even mostly negative. I just think that at times it can be constricting to be Black or to be non-white in the United States of America, and that one can find that there are places in the world where that burden can be taken off, whether it's temporarily or for the long term.
Thomas, we live in a world right now where there's a lot of ethnic struggle and America struggling with inequalities that are lingering. But isn't a goal of great societies, many of them, or at least a strength, pluralism? Do you worry about giving up on pluralism if we leave?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, all of these values are held in tension. I believe in the collective struggle. I believe in pluralism. I believe in the United States of America. I can't imagine, flaws and all, I can't imagine another country that could ever be mine, truly. But at the same time, you only have one life, and you have to maximize the good in your life for yourself and for your loved ones. And so we make decisions that are very particular to what might benefit us to the best that we can see that. So I believe in pluralism, but I believe that the stress-free existence that I have right now, walking up the street and never wondering if a cop is going to come on to me in a certain way, you know, we've had instances of police violence, brutality in my own family. So just to take that off of the table, at this point in my life, it feels more important to me than my belief in pluralism.
Thomas, thank you for joining us. That was Thomas Chatterton Williams, the author of Losing My Cool, and he wrote the op-ed piece in the New York Times, The Next Great Migration.
In WPR's final installment of a series on dental care for low-income Wisconsinites, Shemaine Mills looks at why people may be going to the emergency room when they'd be better served going to a dentist.
Health professionals say for too many people, going to the dentist is not something they plan. Greg Nitsch runs the Family Health Center of Marshfield, a federally funded community clinic.
Where a lot of people, if you ask them when would they need to see a dentist, they would answer, when I have oral pain. if I have tooth pain, well, then I need a dentist. Those folks aren't aware that that's perfectly avoidable. They don't ever have to have tooth pain.
Regular checkups may be recommended, but they're not on everyone's radar, even if they can afford it. Wisconsin Dental Association President Paul Levine.
Part of the problem is education. People don't know what to do.
Levine says if people have a regular dentist, they will be told when to get checkups and how to care for their teeth. If they don't have a dentist and a painful tooth problem crops up, they may head to the emergency room.
Patients will wait till the weekend. Something will really bother them then. At that point, they're not going to get a hold of somebody. The easiest place to go is the emergency room. The emergency room can't solve the problem. They can help relieve the symptoms for a short time.
People may go to the emergency room because it's more convenient, but there's another reason, says Deborah Denoor. She's a public health nurse with Madison and Dane County.
People will realize how much something hurts when they're not at work, and so many people can't miss work, so they wait and wait and wait.
Money's also a factor in where people go to get dental care. Wisconsin Medicaid, Badger Care, does include dental. Many states do not. 31-year-old Danielle Stewart was able to get a root canal after moving to Dane County from Tennessee.
Where I'm from, you know, they don't offer dental care at all. You do not get any. It doesn't, your insurance, TennCare, does not cover any type of dental care, so...
Stewart says she was grateful to have dental services under Medicaid. Dentists who participate in the program, like Dr. Levine in Milwaukee, complain reimbursement rates are low.
The dentists that are on the state plan are reimbursed about 30 to 35 cents on the dollar. That doesn't even cover half of our expenses.
Governor Walker's proposed budget would increase reimbursement in three counties, Racine, Brown, and Polk, in hopes of providing better care to kids. Levine calls it a good first step. Meanwhile, pediatricians and the Dental Association are teaming up to get young children into the dental chair earlier for that first visit. Dr. Jeffrey Britton of Sheboygan is president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
That involves trying to encourage parents to establish initial care with a dentist around age one. That is sometimes a problem because not all dentists in the state accept people at age one. Some of them still want children to be 3 years old before they see them.
Britton says the earlier the better because the bacteria causing decay in baby teeth can later eat away at what are supposed to be permanent teeth. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.